Happy New Year. Council ready.
Good morning, Chief Judge Watanabe. May it please the court. If I, on behalf of defendant appellant, were to come back to this court, let's say tomorrow, and file a motion requesting this court to resolve the issue, let's say, whether the defendant on remand can or is eligible to ask for court fees since he's court-appointed, to hire an expert to assess dangerousness, his risk for dangerousness, given the right to counsel and due process considerations. I would hazard the guess that this court would say, well, that's not before us really. It's not a case of controversy. It's not ripe for adjudication. Try your luck in a trial court, and then on the regular course of appeal, raise that at the proper time. But that's exactly, in essence, what the state is asking now. They're asking for an advisory opinion on the question of the ex post, on the ex post facto question, when it hasn't even been raised, where there is a presumption of constitutionality as to Act 1. It is, again, an advisory opinion that we have brief in our motion for disposition on the briefings. We cite to the Fields case and the Matavale case, and it's clear in those cases that it is not appropriate in this case to issue such an advisory opinion. What is dramatic is that in this case, the issue on which they seek the advisory opinion has not even been raised on appeal, just in their motion. There is another doctrine which is central to this case at this point, which is the doctrine of constitutional avoidance. This was recently reiterated in the case of Hawaii Supreme Court case of Reese versus Carlisle, 113 Hawaii 446. There they state, quote, "A fundamental and longstanding principle of judicial restraint requires that courts avoid reaching constitutional questions in advance of the necessity of deciding them." So what this principle means in practice is that every other non-constitutional issue that might warrant relief should be addressed first on the merits before the appellate court takes up any constitutional issue. So the state has not made any showing that it is necessary for the ICA at this point to address the constitutionality of Act 1. There are many cases coming up the pipeline from the circuit courts where there will be a fair and adequate opportunity for both parties to address all issues. Then the issue of Act 1's constitutional propriety will be fairly laid out for the court, for the appellate courts to rule on. At this point, it's asking for piecemeal decision-making. It's going to confuse the picture as to Act 1. We have the Jess case scheduled for oral argument in the Hawaii Supreme Court February 7th, where they are taking up issues germane to this case. And for all the more, for that reason all the more, this case, this court, should show restraint and let things take their appropriate courses through the judicial process. The ICA basically doesn't have to take any action on the constitutionality question until an extended term has been imposed under Act 1 on a defendant who committed his crimes before it was enacted, and there are other issues, again, In the process of doing so, that would warrant vacating that sentence and remanding it for resentencing. Then it becomes appropriate. But to answer Judge Nakamura's question, there are many other issues, again, that even if the state seeks to apply Act 1 to Mr. Kutzinger, as it says it presently intends to do, the circuit court at resentencing, well, there are many other issues, for instance.
Isn't that the threshold issue that the trial court is going to have to face? In other words, everyone agrees we should send it back, remand the case for resentencing. The first thing the trial court is going to have to decide is, do I impanel the jury or do I go forward with non-extended term sentencing? So isn't the first issue, a legal issue, the trial court is going to have to confront is, do I apply Act 1?
I think that's a fair question. I think another fair question is the threshold issue whether it is necessary under the Constitution that the intent to seek extended term sentencing and the facts alleged to support that should be alleged in the charging paper. That may also be considered a threshold issue, which is not before this court on this case. Cite to a case to answer that, if I could just have a second. The case of State versus Kang, K-A-N-G, 84 Hawaii 352, specifically held that the change of plea hearing failed to provide the defendant with the requisite fair notice of the intent of the state to seek a 5-year enhanced term instead of a 3-year enhanced term.
My question is, in this case, what difference would it have made to your client in this case if the allegation had been made in the complaint versus in the motion for extended term post plea?
I believe it's a matter of fundamental due process. The long line of Hawaii cases, going back to the Schroeder case, the Estrada case, Apollo, and other cases where the Hawaii Supreme Court has clearly and strongly stated that this notice requirement requires the notice be included in the charging paper. And then there's no question at all at this point with Mau Gautega 2,
context of this case, would you have done something different? How would it have affected the way the defendant prepared or responded in this case had it been alleged in the complaint?
Well, we believe that not only is the requirement to provide him opportunity, the defendant opportunity to prepare, but also to give notice, constitutional notice, which again is something that he's entitled to as a matter of law. And that it should be, again, as stated in the law, in the cases, should be included in the charging paper.
There's a tension, though, isn't there, between providing the defendant notice of the factors that are going to enhance sentence and providing that information to the jury, which could prejudice the defendant.
Yes, and that was addressed in that infamous footnote 19 in Mau Gautega 2, where they say something to the effect that the enhanced facts, charging facts, can be withheld from the jury during the trial phase, the guilt phase of the trial. And then in the sentencing phase, that can be revealed to the jury for their deliberation and disposition of that matter.
A bifurcated type of trial.
Correct.
Right. And the Supreme Court sort of intimated that it wasn't going to decide whether the bifurcated system was okay and would defer to the legislature, and the legislature has basically said we go to this two phase system. So
exactly. And I suppose that that same bifurcated system might even apply to grand jury. I haven't really thought that out, but possibly for the initial charging also.
So is it your position that under this bifurcated system, the notice of the enhancing facts must be in the indictment, and it cannot be in the motion for the extended sentence? I think under the statute, is you got to give 30 days notice, right? After arraignment.
That's correct, and I should state that we are addressing this issue because these are the questions being raised now by the judges. We have not had as much time as a state to address these issues. They wrote Act 1 before they filed their motion to vacate. In the formulation of their legislation, they couldn't but be contemplating issues that are being raised as far as the notice issue. This, frankly, is being pulled together by the defense on short notice. We do, as we indicated by filing the notice of intent yesterday, adopt the arguments as to the notice question made by counsel for defendant Jess in his what's entitled Appellant Brian Jess Supplemental Brief filed December 26, 2007. In Supreme Court number 28483. We adopt arguments therein so insofar as it argues that all enhancement facts must be included in the initial charging papers. We also adopt the arguments of the public defender in their amicus brief. But to go on, before the constitutionality questions being raised can be addressed. There are many issues that will come up at the trial level upon resentencing, which clearly call for this court at this point to restrain from issuing decision before, until Kutzinger goes back for resentencing.
Identify the factors that it would be relying upon to make that, to request that that finding be made. So in terms of your ability to prepare for that, hasn't your client had ample notice of the basis for the state's motion?
I suppose, however, for the preparation of the actual sentencing trial, there are many issues which we'd have to prepare for in earnest anew. The pre-sentence report, which is sealed and is fairly sensitive as far as his medical condition. However, the pre-sentence report, in discussing his medical condition broadly construed, indicates that there is in fact a very great need for an expert for the defense to assess his medical condition, broadly stated, and again, which would go to the question of dangerousness. So when we go to the trial court, we're going to have to ask for that expert, given again his right to counsel and his due process rights. There are other issues such as, how is the jury going to be instructed on these Act 1 issues, so to speak? How will the jury be selected? What about the right to confrontation? This is all after the fact. There's a lot of hearsay that has appeared in the pre-sentence report, which now the state is privy to. Many sensitive pieces of information about the defendant.
Counsel, before your time expires, I think you should address Act 1 in case we get to it, because we may very well do it. We don't have an ex post facto prohibition in our state constitution, do we?
Correct.
So basically, we're following the section in the federal constitution that prohibits a state from enacting ex post facto laws, right?
Yes.
Therefore, we look to federal precedent and how that provision is construed, correct?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Federal precedent, federal court decisions, and construing that constitutional provision, that's where we should look.
As far as the ex post facto question, the answer shortly would be yes, but this is how we engage in our analysis. It's clear that we cite to the Weaver case as our fundamental statement of the principle. You look to whether either new acts have been criminalized ex post facto or whether punishment has been increased. The key is that Maugaltega says that the former extended sentencing scheme is unconstitutional on its face. So clearly, you look to what term he could have faced with the extended term statute. That is void ab initio, as the cases make clear. It's of no effect. It's a nullity. There's no jurisdiction for the courts to act under the extended term.
Does that mean that every single statute, every single sentence that was ever imposed under the former extended term statute is void?
It raises that very knotty issue. However, here I am. I'm here to argue for my client, Mr. Kutzinger, who committed his offense, I believe it was in 2005. So as far as him anyway, it's clear that the effect is to impose a greater punishment on him. That case is a pre-Apprendi case. It's a case that was decided pre-Apprendi when the question of whether judges or juries are going to decide facts or going to find facts to enhance or even impose sentence was not a live issue. Therefore, when they say it's merely procedural, it's not in the landscape where Apprendi has made courts sensitive to the issue of whether it's judges or juries who are finding the facts. Therefore, the Dauber case is basically, as the public defender argues in the amicus brief, basically implicitly overruled. It's of no precedential value, really, and it leaves basically the state standing on no case law. They don't cite any case law where the prior statute was found to be constitutional, unconstitutional on its face. I think is maybe the crux of it, and it's a knotty issue, but Maugaltega says what it says, and it says that the statute was void on its face. There's a lot of Hawaii law that we cite saying that any statute found void on its face is a nullity, is void ab initio. And so it raises this knotty question of prior people sentenced to extended terms under the old law, which, in effect, had no effect. And it goes also to the notice issue, go back to that, because if at the time of Apprendi, again as the public defender argues in their brief, at the time of Apprendi this law is void, then he didn't get notice even in that abstract sense of getting notice from what laws are on the book. He can't get notice. Well, no, it's not, because it's void on its face.
If you looked at the Hawaii Revised Statute at the time he committed the offense, he would have had the extended term statute on the books, correct?
It's on the books, but it's it has no effect.
At that point, it had not been determined unconstitutional.
As of the time, this is our argument, maybe I wasn't clear, but our argument is as of the time of his committing of the offense in 2005, Apprendi has been in effect since 2000, about 5 years. At that point, it's not giving him any sort of legal notice as to issues.
It made a difference if the legislature amended the sentencing scheme to have the jury find the find it as opposed to the judge before the statute was declared unconstitutional. Would that have been okay?
In theory, although if it was Act 1 that came into existence at that time, then we'd be arguing the same, we'd be raising the same issues as we are now.
We have the State v. Nakata case, 1994, where the Supreme Court said it was okay to take away the right to a jury and give it to a judge retrospectively, and it didn't offend the ex post facto prohibition.
Again, we believe that Mau Galtega 2 is an anomaly in the overall landscape of Apprendi jurisprudence. And it's clear there that because the statute, again, is void on its face, I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but that is a key which dictates a lot of the conclusions that we're arguing for now. It's void on its face, and therefore... I'm sort of losing the train about what your question was, but given that the statute was void on its face, it had no effect, and it requires a total redoing, would be our point.
If the Hawaii Supreme Court said you can enact, well, you can basically retrospectively take away the right to a jury trial and give it to a judge, wouldn't that seem to think you could basically take something away from a judge and give it to a jury retrospectively?
But I would assume that that would be in the context where no ex post facto problems are raised or no notice
said
problems.
There is no ex post facto problem. That's what they explicitly said. And they cited one of the cases the Attorney General relies on, the Collins case, Collins v. Young.
Well, I haven't looked at that case, but...
You should.
Yes. But again, given Mau Galtega 2, where goes over, it reviews all past case law, relevant case law from Hawaii, and they go through, in the body, not in the footnote, a extended and deliberate review of case law about what has to be included in the charging papers, whether intrinsic facts versus extrinsic facts have to be included. It's very deliberate. And they cite to Cunningham, where this...
Ex post facto is not an issue in that decision, right?
Mau Galtega. No, but this is the point. They talk about their intrinsic versus extrinsic distinction that they've used to avoid Apprendi, basically. And from this discussion, they go directly to the conclusion that because Cunningham obliterates that intrinsic-extrinsic distinction, therefore this statute is unconstitutional on its face. That then, we argue, transforms the landscape, so to speak, and it would implicitly overrule any contrary cases existing up to that point. So it all funnels down to Mau Galtega and that finding or holding that statute is unconstitutional on its face. At that point, they say that basically a thorough reworking of the extended term statute is necessary, the whole scheme is necessary, but they leave it to the legislature. So we would argue that that is the final word, that any other prior contrary cases do not have any direct applicability to the extent that Mau Galtega requires a thorough reworking and a requirement that juries find the facts for enhancement.
When the majority in that case, the dissent saw no problem in or the concurring dissenting opinion, whatever it was, saw no problem sending it to a jury even without Act 1. But the majority in that case didn't talk about prospective versus retrospective legislation, just talked about having the legislature fix it, correct?
Yes, but again, Lago Ortega requires what it requires, and it does require, as we've argued, facts be laid out in the charging papers. The jury decide the enhancing facts. There may be contrary cases, but if they predate Lago Ortega, we don't think that it much has much applicability.
Please, the court. The state asks this court to vacate Mr. Kutzinger's extended term sentence and remand for sentencing pursuant to Act 1 of the second special session of 2007. The idea that this court, in doing so, would be issuing an advisory opinion is at best just simply wrong. In his brief in this case, the defendant asks this court to vacate his sentence, and I quote, and that his case be remanded to the trial court for resentencing. So the defendant has asked that the case be sent back to the trial court for resentencing. At the time the brief was filed, Act 1 did not exist. Now Act 1 does exist, and we believe that it is incumbent upon this court to apply the law as it currently exists and to direct the trial court to sentence the defendant pursuant to Act 1. We did not, in our motion, ask the court to decide specific constitutional issues. We anticipated that at least one constitutional issue would be raised, and we tried to address that issue in the event that it was raised. We are not suggesting that there is a need for the court to make any particular decision on any particular constitutional issue, although we believe it makes sense to address the one claim that the statute is unconstitutional on its face, but rather that the court make it clear to the circuit court that the sentencing is to be pursuant to Act 1. We believe that this serves both judicial economy and judicial efficiency. The court knows from reviewing its own docket, and if not from reading the newspapers, that there are a significant number of individuals who are going to face and whose judges are going to face the issue of resentencing and whether or not Act 1 applies. There is absolutely no reason to risk inconsistent applications. There is every reason for this court, when the matter is before the court right now, to decide whether or not it is, for example, retrospective in its application, which I'll get to in a second, and to the extent a facial challenge is raised with regard to the statute, to decide that the facial challenge ought to be rejected. In this case, we believe that the statute clearly does apply retrospectively, and it does not appear that there's any argument made by anyone that it doesn't. Section 5 of the statute makes it clear that it would apply in this case. The purpose clause of the statute, Section 1, makes it clear that it would apply in this case, and the legislative history, to the extent it was relevant, makes it clear that it would apply in this case. Raised it. Hawaii Revised Statute Section 1-3 says that no law has any retrospective operation unless otherwise expressed or obviously intended, but as the Supreme Court of Hawaii has said, that is a statutory construction issue only, and to the extent that the legislature has made it clear, manifest, or intent that the statute is to be applied retrospectively, then 1-3 is irrelevant, and 1-3 has no constitutional dimensions.
The defense has argued that, well, we didn't even know if the state is going to seek an extended term remand, so what? It would be premature for us to decide. Is the state representing to the court that it will be seeking an extended term remand?
Yes. With with regard to the facial challenge, Judge Foley is obviously correct that the only issue involved here is the federal constitutional issue, and Article 1, Section 10 says that no state shall pass any ex post facto law. There is no concomitant provision in the Hawaii state constitution, and there are no Hawaii state cases which suggest that the ex post facto principle is read into any other provision of the state constitution. In many ways, the federal law as to the applicability of the ex post facto clause has remained in general the same for more than 200 years since Justice Chase took it up for the first time in Calder v. Bull in 1789. And what was set forth in general in that case and has remained the jurisprudence of the United States for more than 200 years is that there are essentially three ways a statute can violate the ex post facto law. Does it punish as a crime an act previously committed which was innocent when done? Does it make more burdensome the punishment for a crime after its commission? Or does it deprive one charged with a crime of any defense available according to the law at the time the act constituting the crime was committed? Those are the three essential ways a statute can violate the ex post facto law, and it's obvious that Act 1 on its face does not violate any of those three provisions that were...
I would give you that, except the defense argues that the analysis changes because in Ogatoega, the Supreme Court labeled the prior version of the extended term statute unconstitutional on its face. How do you read that phrase? What did the Hawaii Supreme Court mean when it said the statute was unconstitutional on its face? And how does that fit into the ex post facto analysis?
Well, I guess what I would say is that the court need not reach the question of what the Hawaii Supreme Court meant, because whatever the Hawaii Supreme Court meant, it's of no federal constitutional significance. And in Daubert v. Florida, the court wholly disposed of that issue, and to the extent Daubert could be put into question, I'm going to discuss Daubert first. Judge Foley's correct that Collins v. Youngblood put to rest any question that Daubert didn't mean exactly what it says. But in Daubert, Supreme Court was dealing with the question of whether the death sentence could be imposed upon a defendant with regard to a situation in which, when the death sentence was originally imposed upon the defendant, shortly after that, the Supreme Court in Furman v. Florida declared the death penalty as it existed in every state in the Union unconstitutional. Within months of that decision in Donaldson v. Sack, the Florida Supreme Court declared the Florida death penalty statute unconstitutional. And while there's an argument in the defendant's brief that somehow the decision in Furman was an as-applied as opposed to on-its-face decision, I'm not sure how counsel reaches that conclusion. The Supreme Court in Furman, followed by the state Supreme Courts in all states that had to reach the question, decided that the death penalty could not be enforced. The death penalty statutes were unconstitutional. Whether you describe it philosophically as on their face or ab initio, the fact is they were void. They could not be applied. Florida completely changed the procedural method in which the death penalty were applied. And while the Supreme Court of the United States described the change as more or less favorable to the defendant, I think reasonable people could differ as to whether the new system set up in Florida was more or less favorable to the defendant than the old one.
I think the defendant mentioned that Daubert was a pre-Apprendi case, and clearly it was based on that Prophet case. Is it Prophet? And it was based on cruel and unusual punishment, Eighth Amendment, right? Not Sixth Amendment. So do you think the case law would have differed if they had struck down the law based on the Sixth Amendment instead?
No. In Daubert, the court completely considered the ex post facto question. The issue presented to the Supreme Court in Daubert was precisely the same here. The fact finder changed. The statute was that was in effect when the defendant committed the crime was unconstitutional. And in fact, the Supreme Court said in Daubert, petitioner argues there was no valid death penalty in effect in Florida as of the date of his actions, but this sophistic argument mocks the substance of the ex post facto clause. That's what the Supreme Court said in Daubert. The Supreme Court specifically held that the changes in the law, including the change in the fact finder, were procedural. They said they were on the whole ameliorative and that there is no ex post facto violation at all. But the court also said that even if they were wrong as to the ameliorative point, even though it may work to the disadvantage of a defendant, a procedural change is irrelevant to the ex post facto analysis. And to the extent that the defendant argues that somehow this doesn't survive Apprendi, the Supreme Court of the United States following Apprendi has specifically characterized the Apprendi rule as procedural. Whether you look at the Ring case or you look at Shiro v. Summerlin or all of the state cases that have followed that case, all of them have said that the rule of Apprendi and the changes enunciated or required by Apprendi are procedural in nature. And in Daubert, this court specifically said that if a change is procedural in nature, it cannot implicate the ex post facto clause no matter what. The issue is warning. And the issue is not warning in a metaphysical sense. The issue is, was there a law that appeared to be on the books that would have allowed the extended term to be imposed in this case? And clearly there was. Whatever doubt that there might have been, and I suggest that there are no federal cases that suggest that there could be any doubt about Daubert, of Daubert meaning what it said, but whatever doubt there was completely put to rest in Collins v. Youngblood, which I would describe for want of a better term as the Supreme Court's tune-up of the ex post facto laws, taking another look after a couple of hundred years. Because the Supreme Court recognized that there was stray language in some cases of their own that had cast doubt on some of the basic ex post facto principles first enunciated in Calder v. Bull, and the Supreme Court in Collins made 100% clear that procedural issues had nothing to do with the ex post facto clause. In Collins, essentially, the change in the law, without putting too fine a point on it, is an appellate court got to make a decision that previously a jury had been able to make. The defendant's right to a jury was taken away with regard to an important issue of substance, and the Supreme Court said specifically that while the right to a jury provided by the Sixth Amendment is obviously a substantial one, it is not a right that has anything to do with the definition of crimes, defenses, or punishments, which is the concern of the ex post facto law. I would respectfully suggest that it is impossible, after reading Collins, to give any credence to any argument that we are faced with any substantial ex post facto issue here other than the fact that it's raised by the defendant. The state cases from the sister states of Hawaii that have faced this exact issue have, as far as we are able to tell, unanimously come to precisely the same conclusion. In the Pilatus case in Washington State from 2007, the court, with a quote that I think is worth giving to this court, said, the key is whether the defendant had notice of the punishment at the time of the crime, not whether in some metaphysical sense a constitutional statute existed at the time of the crime. The issue was exactly the one presented by here, and the court in Pilatus said there is no ex post facto problem. In the Hankerson case from 2006 from Minnesota, there's an extensive discussion in that case about Collins v. Youngblood, about Daubert, about Shiro, and about Ring. And they make it clear in that case as well that a change affecting the identity of the fact finder is procedural and is thus not burdened by ex post facto restrictions. I would also note that in this case, unlike as could be argued in Daubert, the change is 100% ameliorative and in favor of the defendant, whereas in the past, the prosecution did not have to prove that an extended term was necessary for the protection of the public beyond a reasonable doubt. Under Act 1, not only does the prosecution have to prove to a jury, if the defendant wants a jury, that the extended term is necessary for the protection of the public beyond a reasonable doubt, but even having made that showing, the judge is still not required to impose the extended term. This judge still can decide not to impose the extended term, even if the jury finds beyond a reasonable doubt that the extended term is necessary for the protection of the public. So it is clearly ameliorative.
At least that, given Cunningham, the court's prior analysis that extrinsic goes away and everything in effect becomes an extrinsic aggravating factor, and in Estrada the court says that extrinsic aggravating factors have to be charged in the indictment, treated like an essential element of the crime.
Well, I would address it in this way. However one characterizes footnote 19 of Mau Gautega II, and I'm not sure that infamous is or isn't the right word as counsel describes it, but however one characterizes it, it is clearly dicta. But even beyond dicta, it itself says it's essentially dicta because the court in the footnote says it's not deciding this issue. Plus, the court has its own CF of a case in footnote 19 from another case suggesting that notice that's not in the indictment doesn't violate the Constitution. So I would respectfully suggest that with regard to this issue, this court cannot deviate from the Supreme Court's clear prior precedent without the Supreme Court doing so itself. And as recently as this past summer, I believe in July, in the Keikuiva case authored by Justice Nakamura, the Supreme Court said, and I quote, "Extrinsic or historical facts, on the other hand, need not be alleged in the charging instrument and are properly determined by the sentencing court after the adjudication of guilt by the trier of fact." So even if the court viewed footnote 19 as presaging something on the horizon, and the court has indeed set this issue for oral argument in a few weeks, they clearly have not overruled Estrada, Keikuiva, Hulsman, and Kawa. And so the law in Hawaii as it stands now, indeed, is not only that you can't, that you don't need to allege it in the charging document. I believe that the law is you can't allege it in the charging document. And my view is if the court, if prosecutors had somehow were prescient and somehow came to the conclusion that the Supreme Court was going to overrule this line of cases and presented evidence to a grand jury of a defendant's 35 prior burglary convictions, in asking them to make a probable cause determination, the Supreme Court would have thrown out an indictment like that as violating the defendant's rights to a neutral grand jury and or due process.
Beyond the charging aspect of it, what about the nature and cause requirement in terms of the timing of the notice?
Well,
the motion was filed after the defendant fled. So does that have any significance in the context of this case or any constitutional requirement of notice?
I would respectfully say that as Hawaii law, clearly under federal law, no. Under state law, we followed the procedure precisely as set down by the Hawaii Supreme Court and as upheld by the Hawaii Supreme Court in numerous cases. And in this case, for example, I believe it's document 16 in the clerk's record, the plea form specifically sets out, signed by this defendant, that this defendant faced an extended term of incarceration of 10 years as to count one. So the form itself in the record, signed by the defendant prior to his entering his plea, says he faces the extended term. The defendant knew at the time he entered the plea he faced an extended term. And if a defendant like this defendant who entered a plea and didn't know that the defendant faced an extended term, then it would be hard to see how the plea could be knowing and voluntary if the defendant wasn't informed that he was facing the extended term at the time of the plea. How that might affect a defendant like the one in the case the Supreme Court is facing in Jess, who went to trial, is a completely different issue. But in this case, the defendant has not raised this issue on appeal. the defendant had notice prior to the time he pled, and in any case, I believe that the court is bound by the Supreme Court's prior rulings.
How does it make a difference that at the time you mentioned that in this particular case, the charging and the filing of the motion was all done pursuant to existing court precedents? Now, but if the landscape has changed because of Cunningham and the Supreme Court's current, most recent decision in Magatuega, why does the fact that the state had previously followed the procedures make a difference if those procedures are found to be improper or unconstitutional?
Well, there's nothing in Cunningham which suggests that the Sixth Amendment analysis is in any way relevant to what has to be alleged in a charging document. The Supreme Court of the United States has held that the grand jury clause is inapplicable to states. States have no obligation to provide any defendant a grand jury or any particular form of notice except to the extent that they have to comply with due process. And so to the extent that the defendant were to raise it and the defendant hasn't raised it here, we would say it would be a factual inquiry as to whether a particular defendant was or was not denied due process or whether a particular defendant did or didn't have opportunity to prepare. In this case, obviously, Mr. Cunningham, if he decides to contest the extended term below and decides to request a jury trial, he's going to have a jury trial. So as I believe Judge Nakamura pointed out, the facts were alleged that the state wanted to prove in its motion for an extended term. If this were to go back for a trial, the defendant will have had at least a year to 18 months to prepare. And if the defendant felt that the time the trial judge was going to give him wasn't enough, he could ask for more if he needed more time to prepare. But the basic facts that the state relied on in this case was that this was a man in his mid-40s who had had more than a dozen burglary convictions, who liked to burglarize places, liked to burglarize doctor's offices, and wasn't going to stop, and that the public needed to be protected from that. So,
Mr. Bennett, counsel had, Mr. Choi had said if Act 1 did apply and it was remanded, he would move to have an expert appointed, and I assume this would be a psychiatrist or a psychologist to examine the defendant to determine whether the protection of the public was necessary. That couldn't possibly be done by the state before you file a charging document, could it?
No. I would also point out that the record reflects here, to the extent it's relevant to that question, that the defendant did move below to have his fitness determined. There was a panel of three experts appointed, and my recollection is they unanimously reported to the court that the defendant was fit. And that there was no reason the trial shouldn't proceed. So to the extent that there are psychiatrists or psychologists who need to be familiar with the defendant, there are at least three of them in the state.
But Mr. Bennett, isn't the pre-sentence report also to assist the court in determining whether the incarceration or the length of the incarceration is necessary for the protection of the public?
Absolutely, and under the procedures set forth in Act 1, my anticipation is that even if a jury makes a determination that an extended term is necessary for the protection of the public, the court will still have the pre-sentence report to review in making the discretionary determination of whether or not to impose it. So it's first of all, hard to foresee all of the facts that could come up in individual cases, which is a reason that I think would militate for the court, even if it wasn't established Hawaii law, to leave the what I would describe as the due process charging document issue for a case in which the facts have been developed in the record, but that even if, again, that weren't the case, there are more than sufficient protections in the procedures in Act 1 and the practice of the circuit court to protect any due process right of any defendant. No, I don't believe so. I believe that the only question for ex post facto is the legal one, which is, can an extended term be imposed? And I think the answer under the ex post facto clause is yes. I think it's just a legal question. And whether or not a defendant got notice or didn't get notice, I would respectfully suggest is a non sequitur in the context of an ex post facto analysis, especially given Collins v. Youngblood. Finally, what I would say is if the court decided it wanted to reach the issue of whether the extended term facts needed to be addressed in the charging document, as we put in our amicus brief before the Supreme Court in the Jess case, virtually every state court that has decided the issue has decided that it does not need to be alleged in the charging documents. And the two state courts that have arguably decided the other way in New Jersey, I would suggest that the decision turned entirely on the fact that it was a capital proceeding. And in New Hampshire, it turned entirely on the fact that the New Hampshire statute said you had to go before a grand jury if the sentence that was ultimately going to be imposed was more than a year, which was what was done in that case. So other than the New Hampshire case and the New Jersey case, every state court which has taken up the substantive issue of whether under state law or, for that matter, under a federal constitutional requirement, this type of aggravating factor needs to be alleged in the charging document, each court, and I think there are well in excess of a dozen, have decided that it need not be. There are some that are death penalty cases, but there are a significant number that are not.
In the death penalty cases, there's normally a procedure in which you don't have to charge it in the charging document, but you have to give notice of intent to seek the death penalty prior to trial, prior to a guilt determination.
Yes, because there's an anticipation it's going to be the same trier of fact. And obviously, with regard to Act 1, to the extent Act 1 was going to apply by its terms to people who had already been sentenced, there would be no possibility, in a practical sense, of reconstituting the original jury if there had been an original jury. So the legislature had to deal with the situation that it was likely going to face the trial judges, which was to say, we're going to deem that notice has already been given, but they get a jury. So basically, to conclude, the state's position in this case is the question of whether Act 1 should apply to this defendant is clearly before this court. It serves both judicial economy and judicial efficiency for this court to decide it. The statute is clearly constitutional on its face, clearly does not violate the ex post facto law. There is no need for the court to reach the Jess question, but to the extent it does, this court is bound by the prior decision of the Supreme Court, and to the extent that the court chooses to relook at the question anyway, the case law from the vast majority of the jurisdiction supports the view that the aggravating factors need not be alleged in the charging document. So we would respectfully ask this court.
Given the prior Supreme Court case law in Hawaii on that issue, that last issue, can this court overrule it and basically say that the extrinsic factors don't need to be alleged in the indictment? Now that they've basically they've merged the two types of facts.
I don't believe the court can overrule the Supreme Court's holding that the extrinsic facts should not be alleged in the indictment. I don't believe that the Supreme Court has ever said that they need to be alleged in the indictment. The Supreme Court has said they can't be alleged in the indictment, but to the extent the court viewed the issue as muddy enough that it could take it up, we would respectfully suggest that the case law and from other jurisdictions and from the federal jurisdictions is such that it ought not to be required to be in the indictment. And in fact, it is consistent with better practice not to put that kind of evidence before a grand jury. Thank you.
Going back to the discussion of Daubert, it's clear that's a situation where they're discussing the statutes in issue, or death penalty statutes, which don't change in their essence before and after the procedural changes. Daubert is a reaction to Furman, where the explicit ruling is that death penalty the death penalty in three cases was unconstitutional as applied because it was applied with apparent racial bias. So,
your position that this statute was unconstitutional on its face and therefore the ex post facto, it couldn't be applied ex post facto, was the dissent's position in that case, right? And it was not adopted by the majority.
I'm not certain of that, but the point is, just repeating myself, that clearly it's a different situation where none of the cases cited by the state dealt with cases where the prior statute was found unconstitutional on its face. And it does appear that Malgaltega, too, maybe stands alone in that respect, that factually the prior statute, having been found unconstitutional on its face, forces the decision maker to come to the conclusion that we're arguing for, that all he was eligible for, Kutzinger, at the time of the offense, was 5 years, the standard term, and now his potential punishment is being increased to 10 years, and therefore ex post facto clearly is implicated in his situation. Also, regarding Apprendi, I believe that it did address issues we're talking about, but through the grand jury clause as opposed to the right to counsel. In footnote 19 in Malgaltega, it expressly states, Cunningham reinstates Estrada. Malgaltega 2 was issued, I believe, in October 07. It's a newer case than the Kekueva case. Estrada requires that extrinsic facts be included in the charging document. And again, Malgaltega 2 expressly states that Estrada is reinstated. This statement is made after Kekueva was issued. The state mentioned that was in July 07. Again, Malgaltega 2 is, I believe, in October or November.
So, counsel, you would have no problem if a client of yours was before the grand jury and the state was putting forth evidence that this person had to be locked up to protect the public?
No, that would cause us great concern, but again, possibly a bifurcated grand jury could also be designed so that the grand jury could first decide the probable cause question on the underlying facts, and then after the probable cause determination, the grand jury could be introduced with the enhancement issue.
Is that done elsewhere? Do we have a state where that's done, a bifurcated grand jury that you could point us to?
I do not have any other sites or any other jurisdictions where that's done, but if it can be done for a sentencing jury, I think all the more it could be done for a grand jury, which is much more straightforward. Going back to the point as to the lack of ripeness of this case, that the state is asking for an advisory opinion in violation of the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, the track record of the state and of cases, similar cases, doesn't indicate that it can be assumed that even though they state that they will be seeking the extended term, that it will in fact happen. Wayman Kawa himself, when he went back for resentencing, wasn't subjected to any extended term. So cases evolve, the situation of defendants evolve, and the prosecution exercising their discretion could very well decide in this case that the extended term is not appropriate. Same for Malgaltega himself, defendant Malgaltega. He wasn't subjected to any extended term. So the idea that we can assume that that's what's going to happen with Kutzinger is not a sound assumption. And all the more is reason not to issue an advisory opinion at this point or to go against the doctrine of constitutional avoidance. In asking for an advisory opinion, the state is asking basically for the court to give guidance on remand to the circuit court. But this is not appropriate to ask for guidance on a constitutional issue. Such guidance is generally having to do with issues such as evidentiary issues or jury instruction issues, but on a constitutional issue, it creates more problems than it would clarify. The problem, as far as the notice issue in Act 1, is that it deems a person having been sentenced previously for an extended term is deemed to have notice. That's totally inadequate for due process, under due process considerations. That's not how due process works, where a legislature can just basically decide, well, you had notice because you got sentenced before under a statute that was unconstitutional on its face. It's inadequate to observe any defendant's due process rights. And to address Judge Watanabe's question, can the ICA overrule the Supreme Court? Again, in the face of Malgaltega II, it would be all the more inappropriate, given the clarity with which they reinstate the need to include extrinsic facts in the charging document. It's a situation, again, where with Jess coming up for oral argument in a matter of weeks, it just creates more problems for this court to act at this point. There are other cases coming up through the pipeline, again, where these issues will be adequately addressed, and acting now would be a waste. Again, another case to look at for some guidance is the Lorenzo case, the guy who just went to trial within the last few months, lost, faced the sentencing jury, and the jury hung. I would guess that Mr. Kutzinger is a much more sympathetic figure than Mr. Lorenzo. If Kutzinger faces a sentencing jury, it's not at all sure that he will be given the extended term. And then what will have this judge have, this court have acted on if the issues don't even come to fruition in that sense? It'll be a waste of time and resources to act at this point. And again, there are many other issues that will have to be addressed and answered before he even faces a sentencing jury. And again, it just shows the inappropriateness of the court acting at this point. Mr. Kutzinger did have a fitness panel, three panel, but again, as Judge Foley mentioned, that didn't go to dangerousness by a long shot. It went to just his fitness to participate in a trial. The questions as to dangerousness in this case, in Mr. Kutzinger's case, are very wide, broad, and complex, given a family history, his own history, the nature of his priors, and so forth, his own particular personality. There are many issues which raise a lot of uncertainties as to what will happen on his resentencing. And again, it's not at all clear that he will, in fact, be facing an extended term. I believe that the prosecution if they are fair, which I have no reason to question, in assessing the case when it goes back to the trial level, will have to reconsider what they intend to do with him. And given, again, the track record of other extended sentencing cases, it's not at all clear that he will, in fact, face the extended term. Thank you.